Hello and welcome back to Parity Radio. In this episode, I speak to a gentleman by the name of Dan Forster, who is a lettering artist from the UK, whose father was also a lettering artist and like a world-renowned lettering artist called Tony Forster. And we discuss Dan's early influences, his college days, his creative process. We touch on AI a little bit, and we touch on sort of living up to his dad's legacy and if there's kind of a pressure with that. But yeah, I hope you enjoy. For the people listening that maybe don't have the pleasure of knowing yourself, can you give them a bit of a rundown as to who you are and what you do?
Yeah, so my name's Dan Forster. I'm an independent lettering artist and typeface designer. And I basically work with design agencies and direct clients from all around the world. And I've been lucky to work on, all kinds of different projects, really, for things like logos, logo types, packaging projects, book covers, and anything that sort of really needs custom or bespoke lettering or type, that's what I do. So it's, when I say that, it's not fonts that I'm using. Everything is drawn from scratch. And sort of how it works is an agency will come to me, usually a design agency, and they'll be working with a big brand. For instance, I worked with a company called Pearl Fisher last year, and then one of their clients was SodaStream, and they were rebranding SodaStream, and they came to me to look at the logo type aspect. So they already sort of had something in mind, had a direction as to where they wanted to go, but they come to people like ourselves to really kind of craft and refine wordmark. And so sometimes it's a case of they've got an idea. Sometimes it's a case of a client will want me to do some exploration work. So they'll have like a vague idea of what they want, but they want me to sort of explore different possibilities. So in that case, you know, the project can go through more stages and could go in all kinds of different directions, really. So that's pretty much what I do. But I also do, beyond logo types, I do a lot of illustrative and decorative type work as well. So that could be for things like posters or book covers, something a bit more embellishing.
Just out of curiosity as well, have you ever thought about going into just design typefaces? Because you can obviously draw, you know, with the SodaStream logo, that's kind of quite a normal sans serif typeface, isn't it? Have you ever thought about turning that into like a full thing, maybe?
I have thought about type design in that sense, because I suppose you can describe type design in two ways. On the one hand, it's the most obvious way to think about it is designing typefaces. So obviously, like you say, that's full character sets with the numbers, and some of the character sets can be huge as well, but I suppose the other way to look at it is, the other way to look at type design is, it can be custom lettering just for a logo. So it's literally just those characters that are used in the logo. But yeah, to answer your question, definitely I'd love to do typeface design. It's something that I'm actually tinkering with in the background. So I've been learning to use Glyphs. I don't know if you've heard of the software. It's just one of those things. It's time, isn't it? Everything, all this stuff requires time. I've got a few ideas for typefaces that I would like to create and put out there, but they're just kind of background projects at the moment. So, you know, I'll just dip into it every now and then and, you know, do a little bit of work on it. But I do have ideas that come up from time to time as well. You know, you'll see something, or I'll be drawing something for a client or just a personal project, and you think, oh, actually that could be really great for a typeface. So sometimes I get distracted and I'll go off and just draw a couple of characters. I'll park it and then, you know, put it on my list as something to come back to and revisit in the future.
So yeah, at this point, you know, to begin with, I like to ask people where their early interests come from. And obviously yours probably comes from your father, Tony Forster, who is sort of a world-renowned lettering artist in his own regard. But I wanted to ask, can you touch on the relationship you had with him when he was alive? And can you recall sort of the first spark that you ever had that sort of got things going for yourself?
Yeah. So, well, obviously, yeah, he was a big inspiration in my life. Obviously, just growing up around him and hanging out in his studio as a kid was just really good fun. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in there just like hassling him probably and pestering to draw things for me or rummaging through his bookshelf. And, you know, I remember I used to get into trouble for using all his letter set, you know, so I'd just steal a couple of sheets and then I'd use all the D's and he'd go mad. But yeah, it was really good fun. And just being in his studio, like I say, it was full of artworks and books, and he had all these amazing old signs, which we still got at my mum's house now. But yeah, he was obviously a huge inspiration, and he tried to get me to do some calligraphy when I was younger. I think what happened was, because I had a part-time job working at the local swimming pool, and one of the girls there was getting married, and she needed some wedding invites to it. And at some point, I must have mentioned that I did calligraphy, so she asked me, could I do some calligraphy for her wedding invites, and then also for the, you know, all the place names that they put on the table. So my dad sort of, he was like trying to encourage me to start doing calligraphy. So I tried it, but obviously I was probably comparing myself to him and his work, which is ridiculous really, because he'd been doing it for like 30 years or something at that point. And for me, I'd been doing it for a couple of days. So to make the comparison was pretty ridiculous. But, you know, you do these things, you do compare yourself, and started doing the calligraphy, and I got so frustrated. I just couldn't make the letters look the way I wanted. So I tried and tried. I managed to get this little job done, this lady at the swimming club. But then after that, I just gave up with calligraphy. And the other thing I was interested in at the time, I just was drawing. You know, I loved drawing as a kid, and some of the books that my dad used to have in his studio were, there was one I remember by this artist called Frank Frazetta. So he was a fantasy artist. So he'd do artworks for some of the old novels, like, you know, what eventually became Conan, you know, and then all the sort of offshoots from that. So all kind of like fantasy art, Dungeons and Dragons, all that kind of stuff. And I was really inspired by that. So I used to take those books from my dad's, and, you know, I'd take them to bed at night, and I'd sit up with my sketchbook, and I'd just literally copy those artworks. And I think I was about 30 or 14 or something like that, and I'd sort of realized that I could draw quite well. And so that was like the main thing that I was interested in as a kid growing up. And then again, my dad saw that I was drawing, and then he started introducing me to other artists like Escher. There was Geiger, who did the design for the Alien movies. So there was those books, and yeah, there was just a bunch of other books. But also, he introduced me quite early on to the designer Herb Vivelin. And he was, you know, he told me about typography and how you could use letters to be expressive beyond just the written meaning of the word. So that was something I found really fascinating. We also went to Edinburgh one time together. He took me to this typographic circle event, and we went to see Fred Woodward, who's the art director of Rolling Stone magazine, and he was giving this lecture in Edinburgh, and he was just like a really brilliant designer, and he was really sort of renowned for his creative use of typography. And there was one thing I always remembered, which was this magazine cover for Rolling Stone, and he was talking about how he hated using the masthead because he worked with it day in, day out, and he got so sick of it that any opportunity he had to cover it up, he did. So there was this one particular cover with Jimi Hendrix, and he covered up the masthead just enough, so sticking out of the sides, it just said Roll One. And I just thought that was absolutely genius. So there was things like that. Those are some like specific memories that I really remember that sort of really sparked my early interest in design, really.
Have you ever thought about, had you not gone down this route, what you would have become instead of a lettering artist?
Well, it did actually take me a while to become a lettering artist because I started out in graphic design. But yeah, I mean, it's always difficult when you're young. It's really hard to know what you want to do, especially when I was younger. So when I was like at school, when I was doing my options, it was like 1989, 1990. So I think the general sort of awareness of what the possibilities were for work in the creative fields were quite limited. So, you know, I went in, you know, to see my careers advisor at the time, and he told me that, you know, well, because the other thing I was doing at the time was I used to compete as a swimmer when I was a kid, and I was actually quite good for a little while. So I went in and I basically told him that, you know, all I really enjoyed doing in school was art, but I was also good at swimming. And he was just like, well, there's not really many options in those areas, so I'd just advise you to, you know, take double science and, you know, work harder at maths and English as well. So it wasn't really great advice, you know, and when it came to my exams, I purposefully flunked my French exam so I could do an extra art period. So, I mean, art went well, got an A in art, but yeah, at school, I didn't really enjoy it. It was difficult. So I completely forgot what the question was.
It was just if you hadn't gone down this path, you mentioned sort of illustration. Would you have gone into sort of more of an artsy kind of role?
Yeah, I didn't know.
You know, drawing, things like
well,
that.
Because when I started working in design, I loved it at first, but after a period of time, my sort of interest waned a little bit, and I was always sort of on the lookout for something else. So when I was working in design, I tried doing some video work, I tried doing some web work, I ended up doing some app design at one point. So I tried all these different things and nothing was really grabbing me. But like I said, I always liked drawing as a kid, and illustration was something that I was quite interested in. So I started trying to do a bit of illustration work. Myself and my partner, Jan, we set up a little business together called The Lost Fox, whereby we were making and selling screen prints. So I was doing the illustrations and Jan was doing the screen printing. So that was fun for a while. But then, yeah, when I eventually discovered lettering, I knew straight away that was it. And, you know, I was off. Yeah, that was, but it was difficult to, it's just difficult to figure out. But what I'd say to people is, you know, don't stop looking, you know, and it's never too late to change your career. If you really want to do something, you can always make it happen.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Especially nowadays where it's like there's a host of different things that, say if you were jumping from, I don't know, being an optician to something else which needs a load of training, there's a lot of jobs that maybe don't need a crap load of training though. Like you could be a graphic designer, just kind of, you'd never be as skilled as someone who's, you know, got a degree and baddie baddie, but I don't think you need a degree anyway. But you could jump into it, couldn't you, essentially? You could jump into it 2 feet first, straight into the deep end if you wanted to.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, with most professions, there's definitely going to be a learning curve, and there's definitely going to be, you know, a period of time where you have to work hard and invest your time into becoming good in that particular field. You know, it's not like I switched just overnight to become a lettering artist. It's something that took quite a lot of hard work and a few years to sort of slowly transition from one to the other. You know,
doopy doopy doo. There's a lot of different questions that I think you've answered, so I'm trying to filter the ones out. So yeah, when you first got started, I think you were at a stage where sort of people were transitioning from sort of more mechanical means to more digital means, and you would have been in the transition going into computers. Would that be correct?
Well, well that probably happened before I came along, to be honest. So when I was at college, the first college I went to out of school was Wigan College, and I just did a general art and design course. So I wasn't really doing graphics there. It was more analog, hands-on drawing and that kind of stuff. But the guys down the corridor in the graphic design room, they all had computers. But it was the early days. And then after I left there, I went to Sheffield College and did I think it was called Design Communications, the course. So it was essentially graphic design. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we had a computer room, so we had access to computers. But we were encouraged to also, you know, work by hand as well, which I'm not sure if that still happens as much these days.
Hmm.
But yeah, so it was, computers were there. In fact, I actually did an evening class to learn how to use computers before I went to Sheffield College over the summer period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess to rephrase it a little bit then, the computers have come on a lot since then.
Yeah.
And obviously now you have iPads where you can use Procreate to do what you do. Could you comment on sort of the transition from that to where you are now, maybe?
Yeah, it's just something that has always been there, and it's something that is always changing and changing fast. And for instance, when the iPad came along, that really changed things for me in terms of my lettering work. It hugely speeded up the process. It was essentially just like having pen and paper, but in sort of kind of in Photoshop, which you could argue already sort of existed in a way if you had a drawing tablet, you know, beforehand, or, you know, like a Wacom tablet or a Cintiq or something like that. The input is a pen, a digital pen, but it's essentially still drawing. So yeah, the iPad for me, when I first got an iPad and I started using that, I just thought, oh, this is incredible. You know, it's pen and paper, but then you've got the option for layers and you can have undos and all this kind of stuff. But I just tried really hard, and I still try really hard, not to get too sucked into using it exclusively, because I think, you know, that you can just get lost down a rabbit hole making too many layers, too many different options. And I think when you use pen and paper, it sort of forces you to think ahead a little bit more and plan ahead. So, and there's just something nice about pencil and paper or pen and paper that, you know, you just don't get with digital, working digitally.
Jumping to, you obviously touched on, you studied at Sheffield. I understand from when you, this is all just from your LinkedIn. But yeah, so I understand once you finished studying, you got a job at Almwood. Is that correct?
That's right.
Oh, yep. Which is obviously quite a juggernaut agency. What it is now, I guess, whether it was back then, I don't fully know. But it was obviously quite a big known agency at this point, which is obviously quite a big jump to go in straight away. So I was curious, how did you get that position? And also, do you have any memories from that position at all that you kind of you can pull up?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was when I was when I was at Sheffield College, and we were getting a briefing one day, and this project had come along, which was set by the Royal Society of Arts, and it was like a national project. And the one particular project we were doing was to design a symbol that represented innovation. So long story short, I was one of the winners. So I had to go down to London and present the design that I'd done to this panel at the Royal Society of Arts. But what I didn't know at the time, it turned out on the judging panel down there was a chap called Jonathan Sands and another chap called Mike Owen. And Jonathan was the founder of Elmwood, and Mike was the creative director. So when I got back to college a couple of weeks later, my tutor said, oh, you've had a call from Elmwood. They want you to go in and see if you will be interested in doing like a work experience or, you know, something like that. I can't quite remember exactly what they said, but I did end up going over there, did a work experience for about a week, really loved the studio, the office, the environment, the people, the kind of work that we do in. It's like super creative. And yeah, so they offered me a job for when I was, because this was, when was this? This was before I actually finished my course. So I just said, well, yeah, I'd really like to complete the course and then come in. So I was kind of lucky, I suppose, that project had come along and I'd done well in it. And yeah, it turned out I got a job from it. So yes, I always work hard at college because, you know, you never know what might happen.
Did you not, when you say college, is that sort of what I'd call sixth form now?
No. It was just a HND course. So it wasn't a BA or anything like that. So it was just a 2-year course. And I always refer to it as college because it was away from the main university campus. So I suppose, you know, college, university, whatever you want to call it, but yeah, so I was,
How old was I? I was like 19 at the time, something like that.
Jumping forward, so as I mentioned at the start, whether I'll keep it in or not, I don't know, but while I was studying at Staffs University, you came in and you did a talk about your own work, and you mentioned this thing that your dad got you to do once, I believe it was in between university, the college years, sorry, where he got you to draw out the Helvetica A over and over and over again until you got it perfect. And there's kind of a thing in that where he's trying to get you to understand sort of the craft of letter forms, obviously. And I wanted to ask, do you think that that's still a thing? Do you think that people really appreciate kind of the craft that goes into design as much?
Yes and no. Do they appreciate it? Of course people appreciate it. I think it's difficult, I suppose, with a lot of the time with client projects, there's a need to turn things around quickly. And sometimes, depending on the client, obviously, you know, sometimes clients don't really appreciate some of the finer details that go into things. They want things turned around quickly and just something that will do the job is good enough for them. Conversely, on the other hand, you know, thankfully I work with design agencies most of the time who do appreciate craft and attention to detail. So, I guess it's difficult because, on the one hand, there's the analog craft and craftsmanship. So like some of the old school crafts, for instance, like gilding and glass cutting and all that kind of stuff, and many other sort of areas that are starting to disappear a little bit. I mean, thankfully, there are pockets of people keeping things alive, but a lot of some of these old crafts are starting to disappear. But I don't know. I do think with the advent of computers, there was a period of time where crafts disappeared, or analog skills and crafts disappeared. But I think now people are hungry for those more hand-rendered sort of products, or, you know, whatever it might be. I think some cases yes, some cases no.
I think I had a conversation with my girlfriend about this the other day, because we talk a lot about AI is becoming a big thing now, and the fact that you could be able to click a button at some point and somebody will eventually be able to do what you do, a computer will be able to do what you do to your standard at some point. I think it's inevitable, sadly, but there'll become a thing where it's like when you buy free range food. A lot of the time it's kind of the same food, but you're paying for the ethics and the morals that come with it, as opposed to that's what the price comes from, I think. So in the future, people will be able to use an AI to design something and it will be as good as a designer, but you'll be paying, if you were to go with a designer, you'll have more of a human connection and you'll be able to say a human design this. And it sort of mirrors that kind of free range thing of you're buying in the ethics and you're buying in the human connection, I think, if that makes sense in a weird way.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it's
a really different tangent. I know. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm still yet to make my mind up about AI. I don't quite know what I think yet. My initial reaction to it is, it's not good, because it's gonna take jobs away from people. It's going to stop people becoming skilled at creating things themselves, and like we're just talking about the craftsmanship. But then it's hard to see that far ahead. It might be that it requires a certain level of skilled human input in order to get the output from the, you know, the robot, AI, the computer, whatever you want to call it. It is fascinating, but at the minute I'm skeptical at this moment. Everything I've seen that has been generated by AI has a certain look and feel to it, and I've not seen anything that's particularly blown me away. I mean, I've seen really amazing artworks, but I think the reason it's not blown me away is because I know that a robot's done it. And you think, my reaction to that is, well, yeah, of course a robot can do anything, so why should I be impressed? You know, it's a difficult thing, but then it depends who you are and why you're using it. If you're just a business that is
wanting to put some advertising out into the world and get people's attention, then whether a person creates that for them or, you know, the AI creates it for them, then they might not really care as long as it does the job. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think a good way of thinking about it, in my head at least, is it's the same as like Fiverr. So you can obviously get a logo done for very cheap on websites like Fiverr and it'll cost you essentially nothing. But there's a level of craftsmanship and sort of work that goes into something at a higher level that you won't get at a sort of a lower level. You're paying for the work ultimately, aren't you? And it will be better the more money you put in. It's how much you value the design in itself, I guess, isn't it? You know, somebody that's sort of a startup that's really looking at the actual, say they sell cheese, they don't really care about the branding of the cheese sells it, then yeah, maybe a £5 logo works for that or something. Or you're like a plumber or something. Plumbers don't always need really fancy logos, do they? They can do something which is, it's just got a picture of a, you know, a bloke doing something with, you know, plumbing on it, as opposed to, yeah.
But it's also about, I think, because at the moment, these days, it's sort of in any field, I was just thinking about music and like, you can go into iTunes or Spotify and you've just got everything, you know, whereas when I was younger, I just saw like a box of tapes. It's like, so you make a choice, whereas now it's really hard to make a choice because there's so much. And I think with AI in a similar way, it might do that. You input whatever the parameters are or a brief to the AI and it spits something out. And it might be amazing. It might hit the brief first time, might be perfect, but you could be like, well, no, I'll just try it again and see what else I get. And, you know, where does this end? Because it could just go on and on and on. And again, you're in that position where you've just got unlimited choice. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It does worry me in some respects, but I'm trying to keep an open mind about it. And, you know, yeah, we'll just have to see what happens and where it takes us.
So yeah, this is kind of the breakpoint in the middle. I don't know if this is a pointless question to ask because we might have already just covered it all, but I ask every guest the same question. And it's the thing of, if we were just stuck in a lift together and I asked you, what's something I can go away and research from your own career, which has been sort of the biggest influence on yourself? And it has to be kind of one thing, but it can be anything. You know, a person, obviously, okay, a book, a piece of artwork, whatever, piece of music. When I asked Malcolm Garrett, he said drugs, which was amazing. honest to God, he said he took acid years ago, and that's been the biggest influence on his career. And I was a bit like, oh, okay, fair enough. But yeah, so if that was yourself, what would that be?
Well, I suppose the obvious or initial thing that came to my head was my dad. But just trying to sort of not give an obvious answer. I've always been a curious person, and I've always been curious about like any kind of creativity or, you know, any sort of work that I've done. I've always been curious about what else can I try? What's, you know, is there something? Is there a way of doing, approaching a project or whatever it might be in a different way? And I think that's something I've always been conscious of or aware of. I've always been curious. And I think I'm just really glad that I have that. Because I think that has served me quite well from a creative point of view. So I think it's a blessing and a curse sometimes because, you know, you could be working on a project and, you know, you come up with a few ideas and you think, yeah, they're good, they're fine. But I'm always like, well, what else could I try? So, yeah, and then I'll go off down a rabbit hole and spend another 2 days, you know, messing around with ideas. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But yeah, I suppose I could say it's just a personal trait or something that I have. I don't know where it comes from. Yeah, so it's not quite as simple as answering drugs, but I wish I could have said that.
So, yeah, I guess jumping forward again to my next question. I think you mentioned your process a little bit, and my girlfriend is a big fan of yours. She's a big fan of sort of big lettering and things like that. Hi, Sophie, if you listen to this. She won't be. I don't think she listens to them. bitch. But yeah, so she wanted me to ask you about your process, what normally goes into a project for yourself, sort of from start to finish. Do you have sort of a checklist that you go through or anything like that?
Not really a checklist, but there is a process, and I suppose that process is different for client project versus personal project. So for personal project, to start with that, because it's kind of simpler in some ways. I mean, it always starts with an idea or a thought, or like I was just talking about, a curiosity about, you know, you'll see something and you think, well, could I make a piece of lettering out of that? Or what could I do with it? Could I approach it in a different way? So there's that sort of seed of an idea. And then from there, I always start with sketching. So it's either pen and paper or onto the iPad. And, you know, I could mess around with sketches for, you know, an hour, or it could be like days, weeks, months. You know, sometimes the idea comes like really quick. Sometimes it's, you know, I'll work on something for a little while, park it even for over a year, you know, because I just can't get it to work, or I'm not happy with it or whatever. And then I'll come back to it at some point and you'll see it with fresh eyes because you've been away from it for so long. So I'll tweak it, change it, get it to the shape that I want it to be, or, you know, shape that I'm happy with. And then once the sketch is done, I'll go into Illustrator, vector it. I don't always do that. To be honest, sometimes I would just create a high-res drawing in Procreate and then call it finished and that'll be it. But a lot of the time, beyond that, it does go to Illustrator, create a vector, and then even beyond that, sometimes into Photoshop if there's like depth and dimension and that kind of thing. So yeah, I guess there's idea, sketching, vector, Photoshop. That's pretty much it. So
in terms of getting clients, is it word of mouth between people suggesting you to other people, or is it social media?
It is those things, but to be honest, and you know, for anyone who's listening, because it's obviously the $1 million question, isn't it? How do you get clients? Clients will not come to you most of the time. You have to be proactive. So this is something I'm doing actually right now. That's something I do at the start of most years when, you know, client work's a little bit quiet. I'll just sit down, go through my list of clients, and then look at some companies that I want to work with. And I'll spend a period of time just doing sort of outreach. Don't like that word, but you know what I mean. Kind of emailing, cold emailing a lot of the time, clients either on via email or sometimes via LinkedIn, just to try and sort of introduce myself, put some of my work under their nose. And then sometimes I offer to go in and do a talk at the agency, which is always good because, you know, people remember faces rather than emails. So yeah, it's just getting work is one of the hardest things in any, I suppose, in any field of work, if you're a freelancer, if you work for yourself. And what I'd say as well is when you do outreach and you do contact people, there's always going to be a limited response, you know, but don't be put off by that, because you just got to be persistent. That's what it's about, being persistent and contacting as many agencies and people as you can, because it's just a numbers game, you know. And then over time, you'll build traction, people will get to know you. But also, once you do start working with people, agencies, make sure you keep in touch with them, you know. So I have a little, I don't know if you heard of Notion, the software. So I use that to track who I've contacted, but then it reminds me after 12 months and say, right, it's time to contact these guys again. So yeah, that's how I keep track of clients. And you know, I do outreach throughout the year as well, because you just got, even when you're busy, that's the time where you can be a bit complacent about it and you just think, oh yeah, I'm busy, everything's fine. But then suddenly the month after or 2 months later, work dries up and it's like, there's a bit of a panic. So yeah, you just got to keep doing it and just make it a habit.
Do you have a lot of stuff, because you do a lot of personal work, like 36, when you've done 36 days of type in the past.
Yeah.
Do you have a lot of stuff that comes off of the back of the personal stuff?
Yep, definitely. I don't know if you remember the presentation I gave to you guys. There was one project with Jessica Walsh and Walsh, and that was something that came off the back of doing a 36 days of type project. Oh, well, attempting to do it, and I didn't actually have time that year, so I just drew this letter A, and I posted that, and I was in two minds to post it, to be honest, as well. But so glad that I did, because she saw it. And a few weeks later got in touch and asked me to work on these ampersands with her for our identity, yeah.
Yeah, so beginning to sort of round off now. I ask this to everyone, well, most people at the end of the podcast, but it's just sort of the question is, if you could go back in time to when you first got started doing what you do and give yourself one piece of advice, it's very cliche, I admit, but what do you think it would be?
What would it be? I mean, it might be something like that calligraphy project that I was telling you about, where I got frustrated and I just gave up really quickly, that it might be tapping myself on the shoulder and saying, don't give up, carry on, because it's all about practice. And, you know, you're just comparing yourself to your dad and all that kind of stuff. I suppose it was something like that, because, like I say, I did get into lettering quite later on. And in some ways, I wish that I'd started it sooner. But I try not to have thoughts like that, because we're all the product of our experience up to this point in life. So if somebody had given me some advice when I was younger that was slightly different, I might be doing something completely different now and not doing lettering at all. So I'm actually really happy with my career and what I love what I did. So yeah, I wouldn't want it to be any other way, but I know that the reason I'm doing what I do is a product of all the experiences that I've had going back in time. So, yeah, so I've trying to think about the past, or, you know, and just make the best of where I am now and try and think forward, yeah.
You mentioned sort of comparing yourself to your dad a couple of times. Do you ever sort of feel a pressure to live up to him at all?
Yeah, that was a big concern when I first started doing lettering work. You know, well, there was a few concerns. You know, I was changing careers in my late 30s, you know, and I was thinking, well, people are just going to compare me to my dad. That was one of the sort of thoughts and fears that I had. Yeah, another one was, can I actually do this? You know, because I'd been working as a freelance designer. I had clients, but they were all like graphic design clients. I wasn't known for lettering, so I was essentially starting from scratch in a lot of ways. So it was difficult, but yeah, there has been that comparison thing. Nobody's ever really mentioned it. Nobody's said, hey, oh, your dad's better than you, or you're better than your dad, or whatever. Just for the record, I know my dad is like definitely way better than I am. but other people say, don't worry, it's not a competition, you know, just do what you do. And I think everybody should, I think that's probably good advice for everybody. You know, it's not a competition. Just do what you do. Try and do it as best you can. You know, it's good to be self-critical, but it's also, you know, don't kill yourself. And if, you know, if you want to do something, you think you maybe not quite as good as you could be, just keep going, just keep practicing, and you get better in time. You know, everything comes with experience.
I think that's a very nice note to finish on. Super lastly, where can people find yourself online?
Yeah, so my website is danforster.com. So Forster's spelled with an R, F-O-R-S-T-E-R. And my Instagram is the same, @danforster. Twitter's the same, although I don't really use Twitter much, to be honest. I think LinkedIn is the same as well, danforster. So yeah, same everywhere.
Hiya. I hope you enjoyed. If you ever want to find me online, I am Pirated Material. Everywhere you can find me, probably in your local Tesco or something. Yeah, I think that's it. This is episode 24, 23, something like that. And I shall see you again next time. And Happy New Year. Yeah. Bye.